All right, so starting off in the first bullet point here on the first parables of Jesus, it's, as he says, concerning hypocrisy, worldly anxiety, watchfulness, and Jesus' approaching passion. So I just spent the last 10 minutes trying to figure out why he used the word passion. And so Linda looked it up and found it used in Acts, the first chapter, and verse 3. That says, in the American Standard Version anyway, about his approaching passion. And, after his passion. Yes. That's what I was going to do. I was going to turn the microphone right around. There. All right. So in Acts, the first chapter in verse 3, the American Standard, it says, to whom he also showed himself alive after his passion by many proofs, etc. And what did you say the New American says?
It says, to these he also presented himself alive after his suffering by many proofs.
Okay. So I finally found how to work the PC Study Bible that I've got on this computer, and I looked up the word that's used here for passion, which turns out to be pascho, which is just the word for suffering. And it's used 42 times in the New Testament. So, but only three times, at least in the American Standard Version, is translated passion. So I found that a curious term, since it's used by a lot of denominationalists to indicate things that it ought not. Carolyn?
Webster gives suffering as an obsolete meaning for it. So that's probably why. I mean, we find that in other, you go to older translations and there's just words you don't use in the same way anymore.
Right.
The meaning of suffering. Okay, I mean, passion means intense something, emotion,
right.
Intense.
Yeah.
Whatever. So it's just not really used that way commonly.
Okay. And I can't say that in common speech, I've heard it used much at all. So, but
the movie that came out 30 some years ago.
Yeah, that's right. With the Passion of the Christ or something like that. And yeah, I think we made it a point to not watch that movie, having heard several reports of it. Oh. All right. So now some of these topics we've covered before about the hypocrisy, for example. And where else would we have seen worldly anxiety?
Sermon on the Mount,
especially Matthew 6, right? Be not anxious type thing. And I think that this area of Luke right here in Luke chapter 12 is very much tied in with the Sermon on the Mount, but I think the context doesn't quite fit in with it being the Sermon on the Mount. But that's not to say that Jesus didn't use the same words, the same thoughts, a multiplicity of times. And so it's obvious here. And as you go through, the middle of the chapter, so for example, verses 22 through 34, that's essentially the Sermon on the Mount. At least the same thing that's in Matthew, chapter 6. so, it starts off with saying that there were many thousands of the multitude gathered together. So, there's a big crowd here. Jesus is talking to a lot of people. Go ahead, Randy.
I was just going to mention that I wondered a long time ago what the difference is between the Sermon on the Mount and Matthew and then all the places where it's spread about in Luke. And I think the most logical answer is that, yes, he taught for years, and we don't have a record of every single thing he said.
Mm-hmm.
But we have very few records of what he said, and he was speaking to different audiences. So he wouldn't be required by any means to say the same ideas and the same exact words.
Right.
Every time you saw a new crowd that hadn't heard that message yet. And so, but indeed it is the same message.
Sure.
It's the gospel message that he's spreading.
Right.
Well, there were times he was speaking to, like responding to an individual.
Right.
Okay, Linda, you had a comment?
Oh, I was just basically going to say that pretty much the same thing, I guess, as far as...
All right, so what he said.
It like Mickey says, repetition, repetition, repetition. He found if it was worth saying and worthy... The likelihood is that he did say it more than once, especially as Carolyn said, to a different audience or group or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could have been the same once, because in this instance, it apparently is because if you go a little further, he began to say unto his disciples, first of all, that's in verse 1. So therefore...
Verse 1 of what?
Chapter 12.
Oh. Okay. Much longer verse than I thought it was.
Yes, it is. That drew me for that also. That he was... that even though all of these people were gathered around him, he specifically... supposedly he addresses, and we don't know that this is just the 12, but it says his disciples, so this would be the ones who definitely believed him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it says he said to his disciples, first of all, so as you mentioned, and so obviously he is talking to his disciples, which I'm sure includes the 12 and may include many more. But probably not many thousands.
No, but then it was pointed out that in Acts chapter 1, where it talked about 120 that were gathered together waiting in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
So they followed him and listened to him.
Yeah.
So, and that, of course, included the 12, but... it was more than 12. Well, I should say that included the 11. 12 after they appointed number 12. But.
Okay. All right, so there's a lot of things study in here, but of course we've already studied them. It's just a review. So he's talking about covetousness at the
let's go back to verse 1, because he tells them to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees.
Yeah. And he's done that before or later, one or the other.
Well, I put down a reference to 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 through 8.
1 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8. Yeah, usually does.
Okay. It says, your glory is not good. Know ye not that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Purge out the old leaven, that ye may be a new lump, even as ye are unleavened. For our Passover also hath been sacrificed, even Christ. Wherefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So he's contrasting, he's basically saying worldliness is the leaven, or in this instance, the teachings of the Pharisees,
mm-hmm.
is the leaven, and you need to purge it out and liberty.
Okay, yeah. So Paul, in talking there in 1 Corinthians 5, is continuing the thoughts that Jesus had, not only here in Luke, the 12th chapter, but in many other places, talking about the leaven. So, you'll remember also that Jesus said, I'm trying to remember where this is now, when they were in the boat, and Jesus said, beware of the leaven. Go ahead, Randy.
Matthew 16:6.
You want to read that for us?
Yeah, I'll read down through 11. Jesus said to them, watch out and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They began to discuss this among themselves, saying, he said that because we do not bring in the bread. But Jesus, aware of this, said, you men of little faith, why do you discuss among yourselves that you have no bread? Do you not understand or remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000? How many baskets full you picked up? Or the 7 loaves of the 4,000? How many large baskets full you picked up? How is it that you do not understand that I did not speak to you concerning bread? Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And verse 12 says, then they understood. He did not say to beware of the leaven of the bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees.
They really seem a bit dull.
Well, yeah.
I mean, he starts off, and I was trying to quote that, and I thought, well, certainly he didn't start off with Pharisees and Sadducees, but he did. And then they still wondered about whether he was talking about bread. And so, but anyway, this is, so obviously Luke, the 12th chapter, and is not the first time that he's spoken about it, and then here we have it in Matthew, the 16th chapter. So that was, what, 6 through 11? Yeah.
Yeah. Verse 5 says, the disciples came to the other side to see that they had forgotten to bring any bread.
Yeah.
So it sounds to me like they were feeling guilty about not having brought something to eat.
Oh, yeah.
So when he mentions the leaven, he just automatically assumed, oh, he's not happy with us because we forgot the bread.
Yep.
And so he said it again.
Linda.
I just realized that the lead-in to all of that was that the Pharisees and Sadducees had come asking him for a sign, and that's exactly what we see in chapter 11. After he cast out the demon, they came to him and we need a sign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Yeah.
But obviously, he doesn't say anything in chapter 12 about the disciples going, oh, we didn't bring any bread, and that's what he's talking about. So, and he's talking to a large number here.
Okay.
A bigger number.
All right. Jenny?
I looked up leaven, and I saw there's a parallel passage to the one that Randy read in Mark.
Okay.
But in Mark 8:15,
Mark 8.
It's not Pharisees and Sadducees, it's Pharisees and Herod.
Oh, yeah. So Mark 8:15. Want to read that for us? Well, starting in 14.
Now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only 1 loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? They said to him, 12. And 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, do you not yet understand?
He seems to be pretty clear about the things that he's saying.
He's leading them somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Okay. Yeah. So we see a couple of places where the same thoughts are there. And some of the same thoughts that were there in Mark, we see also in Luke. as far as that goes.
So, anyway, the leaven of the Pharisees, he defines it as hypocrisy.
Oh,
this,
yes, that's right.
Text.
Yeah. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. And then, so then, when he's talking about hypocrisy there at the end of verse 1, what then do the next couple of verses, verses 2 and 3, have to do with that?
Hypocrisy is when you're hiding what you actually are, and verses 2 and 3 say that it's going to come out at some point.
That's right, that's right. So, there's nothing hidden that shall not be revealed. And that's something that I think we all need to remember. Right? We think we can hide from God, but it just doesn't happen. Randy?
The hypocrisy of the Pharisees is defined in the first few verses of Matthew 23.
Matthew 23?
And Matthew 23 begins with
one.
Then Jesus spoke to the crowds and his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. Therefore, all that they tell you, do and observe. Do not do according to their deeds, but they say things and do not do them. They tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger. They do all their deeds to be noticed by men. They broaden their phylacteries and lengthen the tassels of their garments. They love the places of honor at banquets and the chief seat in the synagogues, respectful greetings in the marketplaces, and being called rabbi by men." I mean, it goes on, the whole chapter is scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites.
Mm-hmm.
But right here at the beginning, he pretty much tells you what their hypocrisy was. They do their deeds to be noticed by men. They don't care about God.
No.
They want to be seen as being holy and righteous to all the people, but they're not interested in following his will.
Yeah, and I think we've talked about that several times, in the, even just in the review of this, that about the fact that when you want to be seen of men, you've received your reward, right?
Yeah.
You're not looking for the correct reward. Latanya?
And he also let us know that if you don't have faith, more than Pharisees that were not in Acts 20.
Acts 20, yeah. We have to make sure that we have more faith than those Pharisees did. And the Pharisees considered themselves to be the most faithful of all. Paul called it, what? The strictest sect of the Jews. Did you have your hand up?
Yeah, there in verse 2, it says, "Where there is nothing covered up that shall not be revealed, and hid that shall not be known."
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of scriptures for that. Romans chapter 2.
Romans 2.
And verse 16.
16.
Where it talks about, it says, "In the day when God shall judge the secrets of men according to my gospel by Jesus Christ." So they think that what they're doing is hidden.
Right.
And it's not. And it's back in Ecclesiastes 12. I'm going to go ahead and start in verse 13, of course. It says, "This is the end of the matter. All have been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." And verse 14, "For God will bring every work into judgment with every hidden thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil."
All right. So once again, the hidden things are spoken of as being revealed.
Yes.
And, yeah, bring every work into judgment. Some sobering thoughts there, in that, what was that song that used to be in the older songbooks? There's an all-seeing eye watching you.
Yeah.
Yeah. That always gave me kind of the creeps. But Randy.
With the parallel passages. Hebrews 4, 12, and 13.
Hebrews 12.
Or 12 and 13. Hebrews 4.
Hebrews 4, 12 and 13.
Which says, for the word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword, and piercing as far as the division of soul and spirit, both joints and marrow, and able to judge the thoughts and intentions of the heart. And there is no creature hidden from his sight. All things are open and laid bare, the eyes of him with whom we have to do.
Open and laid bare, yeah.
No secrets.
None, yeah.
No creature hidden from his sight. That includes us.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so, yeah, yeah. Were you wiggling your hand again, Linda?
Yes, I am. Because I don't know if you're ready to go on to verse 4.
Well, I was thinking of going to bullet point 2, but...
It says, whatsoever you have said in the darkness shall be heard in the light, and what you have spoken in the ear of the inner chambers shall be proclaimed from the housetops. I found it interesting that... And direct contrast to that in Matthew 10:27.
Matthew 10:27.
Jesus is telling his apostles. He says, what I tell you in the darkness, speak ye in the light, and what ye hear in the ear, proclaim upon the housetops.
Okay.
So what he's telling them is the exact opposite of what the Pharisees are trying to, or the hypocrites are trying to hide their hypocrisy. And he's saying, what I'm telling you, in direct contrast, tell everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And tell it long and loud.
Right. Yeah. Preach the gospel. Yeah. Yeah. So in contrast to verse 3, it talks about whatsoever you have said in the dark, etc. Things that will be things that will be shown. Latanya.
And he also let us know about not their fear. Fear wouldn't kill the body, but fear wouldn't kill the body and soul.
Yeah. Yeah. And who is that?
Giving us comfort.
There's only one.
That's that they're proclaiming that on the housetop.
Yeah, Matthew 10:28.
Matthew 10:28. Is that the parallel to that? Yeah. Be not afraid of them that kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. And there they use the word Gehenna. So, yeah. All right. Further discussion on these couple of points here. So after the killing the body, fear God, fear him. There we are. And then starting in verse 6, it's essentially, I don't know if it's a reiteration or this is where the Sermon on the Mount is in this particular area, but this is once again where we have words just like on the Sermon on the Mount that talks about being not anxious, talking about the sparrows, the fact that all the hairs on your head are numbered. But I think one of the important things that a lot of people seem to forget is, what does he say about our value compared to sparrows?
Many sparrows. Since are you not more valuable than many sparrows?
Oh, okay, yeah. The American Standard Version, it says something similar, but not the same. I just lost it.
And misquoted is positive. It says, do not fear, you are more valuable than many sparrows.
Right, right. Right. You are more value than many sparrows. That's what he said. Okay. So, a lot of people today think that the sparrows are more valuable than we, or that we're all equal. Well, so, all right. And then in verse 8, it talks about confessing him before men. We see we've talked about that several times, and we talked about that almost always when we have an invitation at the end of a lesson. And then he goes into talking about blaspheming against the Holy Spirit and so on. I think we've already spoken of that in another area previously. And once again, where it talks about in verse 12, about the Holy Spirit teaching you in that very hour what you ought to say, that so you wouldn't be anxious of what you want to say. So we have that in another area also. Now this is the one where we found it, I'm not sure we call it humorous, but he's speaking to, as it says in here, a multitude of people. And then all of a sudden this guy says, oh, bid my brother to split the inheritance with me. Go, where did this come from? So he takes that opportunity to teach about covetousness. And where in another place does it say the covetousness is?
Idolatry.
Right. Covetousness, which is idolatry.
That's in Ephesians something.
Ephesians something, something?
5:5.
5:5?
And, yes.
I write 10? Yeah? All right. Ephesians 5:5.
Yes. So, hitting 5:5. For this you know of a surety, that no fornicator, nor unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater, hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. It's also found in Colossians 3.
Colossians 3, yeah.
And
5 again.
Put to death, therefore, your members which are upon the earth: fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. For which things sake cometh the wrath of God upon the sons of disobedience.
Mm-hmm. All right, covetousness, which is idolatry. It seems like there's another place where it says that, because neither of these phrases strike me as the one that I'm thinking about, but I can't come up with any more words other than this. So, plus, it's on the wrong place on the page. I want to say it's on the left-hand page in the right-hand column up near the top. But so look there. Yeah. Okay.
Also have there's a contrast. No, that's not the word.
Ephesians 5:5.
I think we just read Ephesians 5:5. Were you able to decipher the hieroglyphics, Linda?
Where are you?
I don't know. Linda.
What?
Were you able to decipher your hieroglyphics?
Yeah, it's not the word contrast. It's the word content, that we are to be content rather than covetous.
Oh, okay.
As this man was.
Yeah.
And that's in 1 Timothy 6, 8 and 9.
1 Timothy 6, 8 and 9.
Having food and covering, we shall be therewith content. But they that are minded to be rich shall fall into a temptation and a snare, and many foolish and hurtful lusts, which such as men drown men in destruction and perdition.
Okay.
And then it goes, of course, into the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil.
A root.
It's a root, yes. Sorry. And then the other one that I have is Hebrews
13,
verse 5. Be free from the love of money, content with such things as you have, for himself has said, I will in no wise fail thee, neither will I in any wise forsake thee.
Okay. It's interesting as we go through the New Testament how often, apparently, the Sermon on the Mount crops up. Apparently, there must have been some good teaching in that, as Paul and others use it, apparently, a number of times here. All right. So, through 13 through 21 of Luke 12 is all about Jesus now breaking off the discussion that he had with the theme he had going with the multitude and responding to this man that wants him, that's covetous, and talks about covetousness, talks about the man that said, eat, drink, and be merry, you know. But the response to him is, thou foolish one, this night is thy soul required of thee, and the things which thou hast prepared, whose shall they be? But we see that also in the book of Ecclesiastes, whose shall they be? In other words, that where Solomon is saying that we may strive for all the worldly goods, but when we die, they go to somebody else. Whose shall they be? So, it's interesting. It's almost like one person wrote the whole Bible. Hard to believe, huh?
Another scripture for that is Proverbs 11.
Proverbs 11.
Verse 28.
28.
It says, he that trusteth in his riches shall fall.
He that trusteth in his riches shall fall.
But the righteous shall flourish as the green leaf.
11:28?
Yes. This man trusted in his riches that he was going and that he would be around long enough to, as it were, reap the benefits of basically retiring.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's like, oh, I can take my ease now. I can quit. And, apparently he worked for these riches and now he's like, yay, and he doesn't give God any credit for it, and he doesn't look around and say, who can I help?
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah.
But it's another example about the man that built his horns and had so much, and he was going to build another one. I don't know where it is.
That's in what we're studying between 13 and 21.
Luke 12, verse 13.
So, but pulling down the barns is starting in verse 18. So, but that's the story starting in verse 16, the parable talking about the rich man. The eat, drink, and be merry is the part that I remember. But then he says, thou foolish one.
Find it interesting that this man came to Jesus and wants him to be the arbitrator and take his side or whatever to get his inheritance. And I have yet to recall any place where Jesus did any such thing.
Yeah, he didn't divide things between people and said,
He wasn't like, he called this man called him master, and it was like, well, he was recognizing Jesus as a great teacher, and then he's expecting him to be a judge. Or sometimes it says in this commentary that sometimes the rabbis acted as judge, so
because they need the law.
Mm-hmm. So therefore, he was wanting Jesus to take his case, as it were. And Jesus says, "That's not why I came."
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So he takes what the man has said, even though the man hasn't said, you know, well, I love money and I want lots of it. And Jesus knows that he's just being covetous. And he takes that opportunity then to talk about covetousness and use the illustration that we all remember about the barns, and eat, drink, and be merry. And then starting in verse 22, we have another essentially reiteration of almost a good portion of Matthew chapter 6 in the Sermon on the Mount, talking about be not anxious for your life, for the life is more than the body and than the food, the body than the raiment, and so on. Talks about the ravens and the and that. I think in Matthew chapter 6, I don't think he talked about ravens. I think he used another bird. I think he just said the birds of heaven, okay, is all that he said. And that's what it said. Where that story says, are not ye of much more value than they? Yeah.
Interestingly, ravens were unclean for
them. Oh, okay. Ravens were unclean?
Yes.
Consider that. Okay.
Let me see if I can find one. That's Leviticus 11:15.
Leviticus 11:15 about unclean ravens.
Of course, it's
in the middle, so 13 through 19.
It's listing. Starting in 13, you shall have an abomination among the birds, and they shall not be eaten. They are an abomination. And it starts listing, and verse 15 says, every raven after its kind. So, and that's, I guess, restated in, where is it, Deuteronomy? 14:14.
Okay. So. Deuteronomy 14:14.
Yes. Of the clean birds you may eat, starting 11. These are they which you shall not eat, and verse 14 includes every raven after its kind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same. So when he talks about the ravens here, I'm sure they're all going, what?
These are unclean animals.
Yeah.
Yeah. Randy?
Well, being an unclean animal just means that they can't eat them.
Right.
Well, that's true.
But I think he brings up the ravens because they're abundant. Everybody knows they're there. They're everywhere.
Yeah.
True.
When he says, consider the ravens, anybody who's been anywhere has seen them.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just pointing out the obvious. They neither sow nor reap, nor have storerooms, but a barn if God feeds them. So that's he's just making the point that God takes care of even them. And maybe that's the point of making them ravens. God takes care of the unclean animals.
Mm-hmm.
If he's going to take care of them, you think he'll take care of you?
Yeah.
That's really the point that he makes.
And actually, we especially don't like ravens.
We especially don't.
So, yeah.
Especially on trash day.
Yeah.
If it was the same back then.
Probably was. That's right. They got ravens all over the place. So. They probably didn't have laws protecting ravens, though.
The law was you couldn't eat them.
That's right. No law, so you couldn't kill them dead. Were you going to say something?
No, not necessarily.
All right. But once again, there's the contrast going on in Luke 12:27. Consider the lilies, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. Yet I say unto you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. I mean, we look at the poppy fields when they're actually blooming, and we say, wow. You know, you think, no, if Solomon was walking through there, he'd look like a bum. Yeah. Or the, you know, you see the multicolored fields like in some of the high mountain pastures in Colorado and things like that with all the spring blooms and all. And you think, wow. Yeah. Don't think too highly of yourself. Yeah. Because God takes care of everybody and everything. All right. So that's part of the be not anxious thing that he says in verse 22. But in 30, it says, your Father knoweth that you have need of all these things. And then once again, he says to seek his kingdom. See, talking about the sheep, little flock, and the treasure, once again, to lay up your treasure in heaven, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also, verse 34. 33, of course, talking about the treasure in heaven. And once again, in 35, it says it's essentially saying to be ready. In this instance, we're talking about the marriage feast again. It's a little different than the one about with the 10 virgins. But he talks about the servants that are blessed when the master comes and finds them ready. And so that's the application to us, to be ready no matter when he comes. So in 38 it says, if he comes in the second watch or if in the third and find them so, in other words, working, blessed are those servants. But we have to be ready at all times, it says, because you don't know when the master's coming. And so he'll come upon you like a thief. I think in one place it says like a thief in the night. And then when people start reading it, and it's the place where it just says comes on you with a thief, people always say in the night, and it's not there, but gotta watch it. be ready for in an hour that you think not the Son of Man cometh. Notice that he's not talking about the coming of Jesus, there. And so Jesus himself says that the Son of Man will come. Where are we starting? We'll start at verse 41-ish, Luke 12:41. So still in the first point on this slide on the first parables of Jesus.